Coming up, we're getting into the hottest team in the NBA, the Charlotte Hornets, with my buddy Joe O. And then later, we're talking about some of the names that don't get mentioned enough in the NBA draft with Ben Pfeiffer. But first, I'm getting into five thoughts from this weekend in the NBA, some stuff that's been on my mind, and then to talk a little bit about Giannis Antetokounmpo, who's coming back. He's back on Monday night against the Celtics. So we get into all that coming up right now. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. We're talking NBA draft later and breaking down the Charlotte Hornets. But first, I have five observations from this weekend in the NBA, starting off with number one. Was Cam Johnson a mistake for Denver? Cam Johnson this year, it has not been great. He's dealt with some injuries. He had his worst game of the year most recently against the Minnesota Timberwolves. 0 points on 0 for 6. This season, he's taking a career low 4.5 threes per game. He has the third lowest points output of his career compared to just his first and second seasons. And I don't get the sense that there's trust on the side of Nikola Jokic with Cam Johnson. Cam Johnson is shooting only 36% on threes on passes received from Jokic. And if you look at the numbers this year with Jokic's dribble handoff partners, Cam Johnson is just not producing. Jokic and Johnson are producing 0.84 points per handoff. Murray, by comparison, the guy obviously years of chemistry together, 1.09 points per handoff. Christian Brown, who is not shooting the ball well this year, 1.06 points per handoff. Tim Hardaway, 1.16. Julian Strother, 1.23 points per handoff when paired with Jokic. And Cam Johnson, again, 0.84, a very low efficiency amount, worse than what Michael Porter Jr. has done in the past. And he was the MPJ replacement. And at the time of the deal, I liked it for Denver. I liked the fact that it opened up cap space. They got Valanciunas. They got Bruce Brown. They added Tim Hardaway. Like, there's benefits to doing the MPJ for Cam Johnson trade. But the way I've been thinking about it recently with Cam Johnson's struggles here in Denver is, a year ago, prior to the deadline, I was making the argument that Oklahoma City should trade for Cam Johnson. That felt like a good price. Go for him. They add some more shooting. It seems like OKC made the right decision to bypass getting Cam Johnson. Obviously, they go on to win the finals. They didn't need him. And Denver, to be determined. To be determined. We shall see if this will end up a mistake or not. But right now, today, it's looking like the wrong move to target him. And we'll see over time how that improves. Mentioning OKC, number two here, why did Nick Nurse hate Jared McCain so much? Because OKC gets Jared McCain, he is instantly productive. He's been awesome for the Thunder. He has two games scoring 20-plus points already. He played clutch fourth quarter minutes in OKC's win against Denver on Friday. Tons of buckets in that fourth quarter. So Nick Nurse, the Sixers head coach, pre-trade, Jared McCain was scoring 13 points per 75 plays on an effective field goal percentage of 48.3. McCain last year as a rookie prior to his injury was at 19.4 points per 75 on 55.3 effective field goal. This season with OKC, he has basically the same numbers, 19.5 points per 75 on 57.9 effective field goal. So basically the same stats for McCain with OKC as soon as he is acquired by the team compared to last year pre-injury with the Sixers. And the big difference, you can just see him playing with a freedom. They're giving him the ball into different situations. They're running him through actions with the intent of giving him the ball. They're giving him freedom to take shots off the dribble. It felt like Nurse just took that away from him earlier in the season. And like I know Sixers fans who are in support of the trade will say, well, we have VJ Edgecombe and Tyrese Maxey. There's just not minutes for a third smaller guard in the rotation. That's not an excuse. OKC has SGA, J-Dub, Isaiah Joe, Cason Wallace, AJ Mitchell, Nikola Topic, their lottery pick last year. OKC has a stronger argument for not wanting McCain on their team than the Sixers do. At the end of the day, you know, Daryl Morey talks about how they sold high. I do think Morey, from his perspective, he's saying that he's getting ripped for that statement still. Every day, Sixers fans are commenting about that. he, from his perspective, he's saying we sold high because his value was only going to get lower here. He's just not saying the second part is that Nick Nurse wasn't playing him. The reason why McCain's value was dropping was because of Nick Nurse. That's the way I feel about it here. Philly had to trade McCain now because it was only going to get worse. Nurse failed McCain. That's just the reality of it. Nick Nurse failed McCain. The Sixers' cheap ownership, wanting to get under the luxury tax again, ducked the tax. They failed the team as well. And so Philly's in this position where they kind of, sort of feel like they got a shot, but they lost one of their better players, and he went to the best team in the league, the favorites in Oklahoma City. And already they've figured out how to use him. And that's been become very obvious since that deal happened. Number three, talking about trades, watching the Spurs against the Knicks on Sunday. Very fun game. Not like the most competitive. You know, Knicks pretty much handled them. And that's part of the reason why I have this thought on my mind is, will the Spurs regret not making a trade? Because the way the Spurs defended Josh Hart, they do what a lot of teams do. They had Victor Wembanyama on him. They sagged off and let him roam. But instead of ignoring Hart, what the Knicks did was they got him involved. And that led to opportunities for Karl Anthony Towns to crash the boards over and over again and just overpower those smaller Spurs wings players. And I thought the Knicks nailed the game plan by putting Cat down low. They nailed it by giving opportunities to Hart, and the team just swarmed overall. They were constantly on the boards, constantly crashing, looking for second chances. They had 18 offensive boards in the game, five of them by Cat, who was tough in that game, really good. And the thoughts were crossing my mind while watching, as it has a few times this year, but especially against the Knicks. The Spurs are small at the three-four spot. Vassell and Barnes, they got bodied on the boards. Are they going to regret not trading for a forward, cashing in some of their picks or youth? Could have gotten, you know, Michael Porter Jr. would have been pricey. Could have gotten Trey Murphy, would have been pricey, but you could have made that offer if you wanted to. What about even like an Onyeka Okongwu from Atlanta? Okongwu in lineups with Victor Wembanyama would have been pretty awesome, I think. I would have loved to see that two big combination. And I think San Antonio, they're probably doing what OKC did last year, or in the year before as well, where OKC just didn't make a trade. The OKC loses in the playoffs a year prior to winning the finals. They made their changes during the offseason. I think we're in that spot this year for San Antonio where they're like, we're going to stick with what we have and then reevaluate this summer rather than make a midseason trade and risk hurting chemistry. But, you know, Johnson has been so good as a head coach for San Antonio this year. He's pulled a lot of the right strings, but I'm surprised we didn't see two bigs in that game against the Knicks. This season, we've only seen 91 total minutes of French Vanilla, Wemby, and Luke Kornet. Only 91 minutes. I'm just kind of shocked by that. It hasn't been great when they've played together, but I mentioned this all the time. Last year, when Chet Holmgren and Isaiah Hartenstein hadn't played together a lot, they were both injured. Mark Daigneault was asked by OKC media, why are you playing them together when it's not always working? And he gave a long, elaborate answer about how, hey, we're in a position where we're evaluating and trying to put these guys in a position so they can succeed in the postseason. Chet and Ihart played 15% of their total minutes together on the court last season. We've barely seen Kornet with Wemby, but I thought that Knicks game showed that there might be a moment where it's needed in the playoffs. And I wish they were using that now. And with Luke Kornet, we know he can protect the rim. We know he's a lob guy. We know he makes good decisions as a passer as well. I want to see him play with Victor a little bit more often down the stretch in order to prepare for the postseason. And in the back of my mind, I'm also wondering, is there any chance we'll see Kornet go back to shooting threes? He had 129 made three-pointers in the first three seasons of his career. He's had only 19 in the 5.5 years since then. He got rid of the three-pointer. He became more of a rim-running center, but he was a 35-36% guy from three. That's a threat for a 7-plus footer. And so I wonder if maybe we'll see Kornet play some 4 and 5 next to Victor Wembanyama and maybe hit the three-pointer again, because that would help solve what they decided not to fix at the deadline with a trade for a bigger four. Number four, Miami exploited a problem in Houston. On Saturday, we saw the Heat play zone defense a lot against the Rockets. 46 of their 97 plays against Houston were with the zone. Houston had a 107 offensive rating against man-to-man defense. They had a 65 offensive rating against the zone. Awful. So Houston, they shoot 8% worse effective field goal against the zone. So against man defense, Houston is 29th in the NBA in three-point rate. Only 34% of their shots come from three-point range. Against zone defense, they're 13th in the NBA against three-point rate with 53% of their shots coming from three. And that's why Miami did this against Houston. They wanted to turn Houston into a three-point shooting team. That 34% to 53% increase is the fourth largest increase in the NBA when teams are facing a zone behind the Suns, the Knicks, and the Wolves. But those three teams are happy to shoot more threes. They want to shoot more threes. They're better, more efficient when they're playing against a zone defense. The Rockets, like I said, are worse. 8% worse with effective field goal percentage. And I am watching that game against Miami. Great game plan by the Heat. Really well done by Spo. But then with Ime Udoka on the other side, it's been a topic all year long. Their offensive struggles, endgame situations, getting stagnant. I wonder if we're going to see teams just pull that out against Houston in the playoffs and say, you're going to have to score against the zone, and you don't have the ability to kill us with two bigs anymore because Steven Adams is out for the year. You don't have the ability to break down our defense with creation because you don't have Fred VanVleet. Like, it's just, it feels outrageous in some ways to like talk about Houston this way because they're in third place. They have a really weak schedule this week. They're probably going to win every game this week. I would hope they win every game this week. They got games against the Wizards, the Warriors without Steph, and the Blazers without Avdija. They should win all three of those games before they face San Antonio on Sunday, a big national TV game on NBC. So the Rockets might be 40-22 going into that game against the Spurs on Sunday. And yet I kept thinking to myself, is their season over already? That's where I'm at right now with the Rockets. I have major, major concerns. And I think the Heat put that on display with how easy it is to turn them into an inefficient shooting team, even worse than what we often see from them in the half-court situations. Last thought here before we get to conversation about the Charlotte Hornets. Mo Diawara. Pooh, boy. I mean, he had a big coming-out party on Sunday for the Knicks in their win against the Spurs. He had 13 attempted three-pointers in 15 minutes. That's the most threes per minute that any player has ever had in NBA history, 13 threes in 15 minutes. And he's letting it fly this year, 39.8% from three-point range on 83 total shots. He was the 51st pick in the draft, late second rounder. He played in Cholet last year in France, and he took only 2.2 three-pointers in 20 minutes per game. Shot only 28% on those threes. He was inefficient on open threes. He was inefficient when contested. He was more of a slasher. That's what he's done a lot overseas. And he still does that for the Knicks. It's why I'm bullish on him. He's not just like some spot-up three-point shooter who doesn't offer anything else. He's a slasher. He can put the ball on the floor a little bit, get to the rim. We saw that from him throughout this season. But the shooting with what he provides, I wonder how for real this is. At 40% right now, almost 40%, compared to sub 30%, basically at every other level of basketball overseas. Did the Knicks fix something? I've watched a lot of his shots. I compared it to what he did in Cholet. I'm not noticing anything dramatically different with the way he's holding the ball or his footwork or anything like that. But he's looks comfortable when contested, when open. It doesn't matter. He seems for real. I want to look into this. I haven't looked into it yet. I wonder if there's something changed mechanically with his hands or the where he's looking at the rim. I want to look into this and find out more because this sudden improvement to go from a guy that barely ever took threes for years overseas was a slasher to becoming a guy that sets the most attempted threes per minute in a game ever, I just can't fathom. I cannot fathom how we have reached this point with Mo Diawara, but he seems for real, and he looks like a guy that belongs in the playoff rotation. And one more thing before we get to the Hornets, we have some breaking news here. Giannis Antetokounmpo is coming back on Monday night against the Boston Celtics, according to Shams Charania. He says that Giannis, after missing 5+ weeks with a right calf strain, is making his return against the Celtics. This is interesting. It's very fascinating here for the Bucks because they've been pretty good, and they had a really horrible loss against the Bulls over the weekend, a terrible loss. But since they've had Ryan Rollins and Kevin Porter Jr. both healthy, the team's been competitive. They've been racking up some wins. They're still only 3 games back from the Hornets for the 10 seed. And so you add Giannis to this group right now, you can't rule out the Bucks making a little bit of a run here. You know, 3 games back from Charlotte, 3.5 back from Atlanta, 5 back from Miami. I don't think they're going to rise that much up the standings, but don't forget about the Bucks. I know Milwaukee fans probably have some mixed feelings right here because the Bucks, as of now, have the 10th best odds. They can't move up to get the number one pick because the Atlanta Hawks have the rights to swap that pick, but New Orleans and Milwaukee both have top 10 odds. The Bucks could end up with 2, 3, or 4. And if they slip into the play-in and win a couple games and get into the playoffs as a 7 or an 8 seed, well, that chance is gone. And that chance might be what actually sets your team up for a bright future post-Giannis or a continually bright presence with Giannis Antetokounmpo moving forward if he decides to stay in Milwaukee. That could be your best bet to get a star player in a trade or a young star player to grow with Giannis. And so if I'm a Bucks fan right now, I'm like, oh, geez, I hope we stay in the lottery. It's not like we're going to win in the postseason. But at the same time, who knows? You know, who knows when you have a player of Giannis's caliber? I just don't see this team going anywhere. So I'd be rooting for the lottery still. But we'll see. We'll see what happens. We get Giannis back on the floor and the Bucks playing some of their better basketball of the year until that Bulls loss, which was, scratch it off, that was an embarrassment. But other than that, they've been playing a lot better as of late. So we'll see. With Milwaukee, will they catch Charlotte or one of the other teams in the play-in? Currently as the 11th seed, 26-33 on March 2nd with Giannis Antetokounmpo coming back. Speaking of the Charlotte Hornets, my friend Joe O, he's a Warzone streamer. You can find him on Twitch. Him and I have been friends for a few years now. He's a big, big Hornets fan, really knows basketball. He's played basketball in his life as well. I wanted to bring him on and talk Charlotte. So him and I get into that coming up. And then later, I get Ben Pfeiffer to talk NBA draft. But right now, let's talk about the hottest team in the NBA, the Charlotte Hornets, with Joe O. Are now joining me to break down the hottest team in the NBA, the most fun team in the NBA, the Charlotte Hornets. It's Joe O. Joe, how are you?
I'm doing phenomenal, man. I'm so glad to be here. Big fan of you, and I'm stoked to talk about Charlotte. And dude, they've been balling, man. I'm stoked.
They've been absolutely balling. We'll talk a little bit about you with Warzone and streaming and all that a little bit later. We're going to start off with NBA, though. The Hornets, they have the NBA's best statistical lineup. It's hard to fathom, Joe, that we're at this point, but the 5-man lineup of LaMelo Ball, Brennan Miller, Con Knipple, Miles Bridges, and Musa Diabate have the best net rating of teams, of lineups with 200-plus minutes. They have a 136.8 offensive rating, a 107.3 defensive rating, number one in the NBA with a 29.5 net rating ahead of the Pistons, Suns, Wolves, Rockets, 5-man lineups. Who could have seen this coming this soon, Joe?
Nobody. And it's funny because for years, I'd be embarrassed to tell people, like, yeah, I'm a Hornets fan. And they're like, oh, man, they feel bad. And now I'm like, finally. I'm like, we're getting a good team. We're healthy, which has been, I think, the number one problem is it's been tough to have a good 5-man when every other game, or especially year with Brandon Miller, there's always something going on. And now that we have a healthy roster, Charles Lee might be contender for coach of the year. I'm like, dude, we're balling. And I'm just stoked, man. Finally, I have a good team I can root for. And come on, man, I'm stoked.
I mean, how old are you, Joe?
I'm 28.
So you're 28. Basically, your whole life, the Hornets have sucked.
They've sucked. I mean, a couple Kemba years were all right, but I think most of the time, anytime
average,
I say Hornets,
average at best, right?
Average at best. And anytime I've ever said Hornets, people always feel bad. And any game I've ever gone to, until I would say like this year, I always feel bad for the players because everybody in the crowd is cheering for the other team they're playing more than the Hornets. And I'm like, this is terrible, man. And now we're finally getting to a point where there's actual Hornets fans and the games are getting packed. And I'm just stoked, man.
What has the crowds been like there? Because I haven't been to a Charlotte Hornets game for what it's worth. I've only been to Charlotte two or three times, but it was for All-Star Weekend back in 2017, 2018, whatever year it was. And obviously that's not a Hornets game, but I've never been to a Hornets game. What are the games like
now?
Is
it a good crowd? It's a good crowd now. First of all, we definitely have to change that. So we got to get you out to Charlotte. We got to go to a game. Maybe playoff game. You never know. But we got to get you out to a game. And it's so much better now because I've been in the past probably 4 or 5 years. And most of the time, if they're ever playing any team, there's more fans for the other team superstars than the Hornets. And honestly, like as a fan, I would feel bad because I'm like, imagine playing for a franchise and knowing that people are coming to watch the other team play more than the Hornets. And now it's been so much better that there's actual like Hornets fans out and I've been seeing like actual Hornets jerseys, like any place I go. And I like that because I'm like, now it's actually creating a culture of people that care about the franchise and care about the player base and just players in general. And I'm just happy for the Hornets, man. Finally, they're trending in the right direction.
I mean, the thing is, like, part of the reason for their success is, A, they shoot a ton of threes. You know, Charles Lee was an assistant with the Celtics. They're fourth in the NBA in three-point attempts, third in the NBA in three-point percentage. But also, another thing, again, like some of these recent champions, the Thunder and the Celtics, that these teams have, the quality that those teams have is flexibility with lineups, but also just creation from all over the floor, like LaMelo and Miller and Bridges and Knipple and guys off the bench, Sion James and Josh Green. All these guys can shoot, dribble, and pass and make quick decisions. And that's why I thought earlier in the year, the Hornets were one of the funnest teams in the NBA. They were fun. They sucked, but they were
fun to watch.
And now, they're good and they're fun. It's translating. What's the difference, you think, between that early season fun that wasn't leading to winning and now the current fun where it's a lot of winning?
Well, I just think also because they're so young, they're just a fun team to cheer for. I think they're the second youngest team in all of the NBA. So I feel like it's just a fun team to cheer for. And obviously, as time goes on, they're going to learn like how the team can mesh together and how they can play together because they are so young. I mean, now, especially threes, everybody loves that. I mean, obviously, some people are like, I'm so tired of the NBA being just ruined by three-pointers, but I love to see it because they're just, they spread the floor so well, especially Khan. I mean, that guy, I'm not going to lie, as they first drafted him, especially like early summer league and stuff, I wasn't the highest on him. I was like, he's good, but I just didn't know. And now, in my opinion, he is the rookie of the year for sure. He's playing out of his mind and they just spread the floor so, so well.
Yeah, Con Knipple, I mean, it's neck and neck between him and Cooper Flagg. I waver between them. Like, Con has just been so steady from start to today, and whereas Cooper's missed time, and Cooper's also had some highs, he's had some lows. Cooper's had some greater highs, but Con is just every night, night in, night out, really
he's
good
so
for
fun
Charlotte.
To watch.
I mean, like, this dude is just unbelievable, and Con Knipple, he's having one of the greatest shooting seasons we've ever seen. It's really an all-time great shooting season from Con Knipple. This year, 44% on 8 three-point attempts per game, Joe. Coming off of screens, there's plays where he catches the ball running straight away from the basket, Clay-esque. And
I was going to say the same thing. It gives me Clay Thompson vibes every time I watch him. And 44% as a rookie. Like, we're not talking like a vet that's played a couple of years, like slowly, just like acclimating to an offense. As a rookie, he's shooting 44%. Like, that is insanity. And every time I watch him, he just, like, you cannot leave him. He's coming off pick and rolls. Anybody that is guarding him, I feel like it's a nightmare matchup. I would hate to be guarding him knowing I have to chase this guy around the whole game. And he's putting up, like I said, 44% from three as a rookie is just insane numbers.
it's historic, really. I mean, like, if you look historically, above 40% on above 8 attempts per game, that's not done often in NBA history. Steph did it 6 times. Klay did it 3 times. Duncan Robinson did it twice. And then a bunch of guys did it once. Dame, CJ McCollum, Buddy Hield, Dante DiVincenzo, Malik Beasley, and Ray Allen. That's of players that appeared in at least 60 games. And so now you get Con Canipoli. He's going to do it as a rookie, the first guy to ever do it as a rookie. And his volume's trending up. He's taken nine 3-pointers per game in the month of February. And you mentioned it, Joe. Like, when people talk about shooters, and oftentimes when they talk about Con, the Klay comparison comes up automatically. Like, when I interviewed Con Canipa last year pre-draft, he mentioned Klay Thompson to me. He's like, I love to play like Klay, and he does play like Klay. But the thing is, he's shooting 47.4% on 3-pointers off the dribble. That's the best percentage in tracking data history since 2013, minimum 100 shots. And so to put that into perspective, Klay shot 44.7% in 21-22, 41.7% in 2017-18, and he didn't even reach 100 shots in those years. And so Con, he's running pick and roll too. Like, his pick and roll volume is greater than it ever has been for Klay Thompson in his entire career. Con's running 8.2 pick and rolls per game. That's more than Klay Thompson ever has. And obviously the Warriors weren't a heavy pick and roll team, but it just speaks to where Con is today, where he can use pick and roll as a playmaker, getting into the teeth of the defense, making kick out passes, finishing inside, pulling up from mid-range, pulling up from three. The dude's a dominant force, and he's only a rookie.
And he's a rookie. And I think it also speaks to Charles Lee and his coaching staff to instill that confidence, again, as a rookie, that you can do that. I feel like most of the time for your first couple years, people play just kind of timid because they don't just have the confidence from their staff to be like, hey, you have the green light. Like, we trust you to do whatever you want. And that speaks to Charles Lee and how he's turned around this franchise already. I mean, obviously, a couple of, like, early years were just rough, but also the Hornets were not healthy until now. So it truly speaks to just how much he's instilling in his players' confidence to play like that, and how just credible it's been for Con now. He is, but I mean, I think he's playing just some of the best just basketball and shooting basketball I've seen in a long time.
I mean, I thought he wasn't an all-star, but he was like a borderline. Oh, should he be an all-star? Should he be a replacement all-star? And like, I think those all-star games are going to come for him. And Charles Lee, I mean, you mentioned it. He just puts guys in the positions to succeed. I mean, the amount of guard pick and rolls they run and dribble handoffs with Sion James comes in right away and plays a big role. And really, though, like you said, I mean, it was a rough couple years at first, but they're healthy now. And LaMelo's healthy as well, and his importance to the team is critical to their offense. Like, everything I said about Con as a ball handler is fair, but with LaMelo Ball, if you look at their 5-man lineup having the best net rating in the NBA, if you remove LaMelo Ball from that equation, their net rating falls apart because their offense falls apart. Their defense stays great. They have a 108.3 defensive rating with LaMelo Ball off the floor, but their offensive rating craters to 91.9. And so they go from a plus 29.5 net rating with all five of those aforementioned starters on the floor to minus 16.4 when you remove LaMelo from the equation. And everybody knows what LaMelo Ball does. Shot creator, dynamic, fun, highlight reel, and all that. But isn't this why you get Coby White? So when you lose LaMelo and all he provides, Coby White can come in and provide a little bit of that?
I mean, his first game, like his first actual game against Portland, I mean, 20 points for his first game. I think he's going to be such a great backup point guard because, again, that does scare me for the past couple of years. He's obviously had a lot of ankle problems. And seeing LaMelo play, it is truly a highlight reel every game. And the shots he takes, I'm pretty sure he's shooting, I think, 37% from three. And it's not like these shots he's taking are like COD, like catch and shoot shots, something like that. He's shooting step backs off the dribble, tough shots. And he is really a highly real. But also, Coby, I feel like he's going to just be a great player off the bench too. And his first game, again, in Charlotte against Portland, I mean, 20 points off the bench. I mean, I'll take that all day long.
Yeah, ultimately, I think that's they're filling gaps in the roster. And I think that this team isn't ready to win a championship yet, but they're competitive. I think they'll be a tough out. And having LaMelo Ball, he's like really, he's one of the reasons for their great success. He's a selfless star. He's willing to pass the ball around. He can score in higher volume when necessary, but he just is on and off. Like sometimes he's hurt, sometimes he's not, and hopefully he can stay healthy. But so far this year, Kobe White's played 54 minutes. Only 11 of those minutes have been with LaMelo on the floor. So they're clearly staggering those two and trying to get Kobe White minutes as the only guy out there. I'm curious, have you ever seen LaMelo Ball driving, Joe? In the real world.
I'm not going to lie.
Have you passed by?
I actually lived uptown Charlotte for 2 years, and I would walk my dog and I would see him drive. Well, I would hear him first and then I would see him driving. The rumors are no joke. When I saw that, it was so funny because I'm like, dude, I don't see him driving all the time in a pink Rolls Royce or whatever. And everybody's like, that's freaking LaMelo. And I would be like clutching my dog, like, not like this. But yeah, after I saw that, obviously all the stuff came out, all the videos, I was laughing. I was like, I saw that for many years, man. So it's great.
I mean, there's been videos of him like going through reds and cutting in front of cars for a long time. Like you've seen videos, and then the recent one with the Hummer, the accident. I saw people saying like LaMelo's license should be taken away, and maybe it should be. I think he should be required to use a self-driving car. LaMelo should only be able to
get him a Tesla
full self-driving. Yeah, that's it.
Get him a
Tesla full self-driving, or like bring Waymo to Charlotte. One of the two. He needs to be required for the safety of the citizens. play. You can't have LaMelo getting hurt.
It's been too many years of him being injured. I want him healthy, bro. Okay. Just that's all I want right now. But it's so funny because after I saw like all the comments, and I was like, dude, I lived up to, and I was like, I lived up to him too, and those were no joke. I would hear him first, and I'm like, oh no. I'd be like, get my dog closer to away from the side. I'm like, no, we're not doing this, man. So that's hilarious.
Oh my God. I mentioned the on-offs with LaMelo. I want to look at the on-offs for the opposite side of the floor with Musa Diabate, I think the most underrated player on the Hornets. Yep. Nobody ever talks about him, but the Hornets defense this year, like I said, plus 29.5 with that starting five. Their defensive rating goes from 107.3 with Musa to 130.8 without him. So they go from a plus 29.5 net rating to minus 1.9. And with Diabate, I talked about him on the podcast a couple of weeks back, a little bit before the fight and the suspension and all that. I think it was that episode when we talked about him. And he's unbelievable as a defensive player. This season, Joe, 32 bigs have defended at least 800 pick and rolls. Musa has switched on 27% of those. That's the third most in the NBA behind Bam Adebayo and Nick Claxton. Kalk Brenner, the Hornets backup center. Really, that's the best company possible, especially next to Bam. Kalkbrenner is second least of those 32 bigs in switching, ahead of only Donovan Clingan with the Portland Trailblazers and behind only Nikola Jokic, just to give some perspective on how they play. They want to switch. That's what they want to do with Musa Diabate. He's able to switch on to guards. He's able to switch on to forwards. He's just so active on the perimeter, so quick. In a game against the Rockets a couple weeks back, he switched on to Kevin Durant and just completely contained him on his drives to the basket. And that's what Diabate does over and over. What do you see from Musa as a really important piece to this Hornets defense? And why is he so underrated, do you think?
I think that the number one thing that is just so overlooked is his motor is insane. He plays hard every single possession. And that is my favorite thing off switches, off any play. I know that he's going to play the hardest, probably on the floor. And that is my favorite thing about any player. I love to see somebody playing that hard. Even on the offensive end, he's averaging like 3.7 offensive rebounds a game. So you know he's crashing the boards. He's going to be playing hard every possession. And like I think that he is the glue of our offense, hands down.
Yeah, definitely is. I mean, he's the glue of the team. I think he's just the most underrated player, arguably in the whole league. Really,
I mean, because like the Hornets are
the hot topic right now, and it's always rightfully so about Con and LaMelo and Brandon Miller. We haven't mentioned Brandon Miller yet with the leap he's taken. He looks like Paul George out there, Paul George plus sometimes. But like, it's always about those guys. Musa Diabate just he's overlooked. It's just the reality of it. But he's one of the better defenders in the whole NBA this season. And he's integral to the reason why they've turned their season around, because they've figured out this guy, like you said, the hustle. He is constantly running the floor in transition. He's up the floor. He's the first guy up on defensive transition plays. He's trying to get back and corral the ball handler. The dude's everywhere all at once, and he does all the little things. He plays hard. He sets screens. He cuts. He rebounds. I love him. I think he's exactly the type of center that teams want to have if they want to make a run in the playoffs. And that's the thing with this Hornets team. I mean, like they, like I said, they're in the play-in right now. They're the 10 seed in the East. They're probably not going to be upsetting their way to an NBA Finals, but this team has.
But it's a scary team. It's a scary team.
They're scary. They're gonna be a hard out, and I wouldn't be shocked if they upset somebody in the first round. I really wouldn't be. I don't think that's outrageous to say. Do you?
If they can stay healthy, I would not be surprised either. But that's been the number one problem over the past few years, is just they got to stay healthy. And they're the 10 seed, right?
Yes, 10 right now. I think 30 right now, and 31 right now, they're the 10 seed, yes.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure in the next couple games that they're playing the Mavericks, which should be hopefully a win, Celtics, Heat. They could make a run, man, and I'm excited because there's nothing like playoff basketball. Obviously, I do love it, all these games now, but playoff basketball is when you see teams actually play hard and actually care more than they usually do, and especially I just can't wait, and I think they could actually upset a team. I truly do.
It'll be interesting there, because I think, you know, the East standings right now, the Magic, Heat, Hawks and Hornets are currently the four play-in teams, and then the Bucks are lurking at the 11th seed. They're maybe they get Giannis back, maybe they don't. But with Charlotte, they're in a position right now in the East where, you know, they're only two games back from the Magic to get the 7th seed, because with the 7 and 8 slots and the play-in, you only have to win one game versus two games as the 9 or the 10 seed, and they're only 3 games up on the Bucks, who, like I said, we'll see what happens with Giannis, if he does return or not. But ultimately, the Hornets are so hot right now, and they're even only 3.5 back from the Sixers. And we're running out of time here. We're already in March. There's only 6 weeks left in the year to actually get all the way to 6. But the way they're playing, I wouldn't rule them out moving up even to 6 or 7. And I wouldn't rule out a first-round upset, depending on if they're healthy, like you said, and how the series goes, and depending on how they shoot the ball in the first round. Because ultimately, since the middle of January, when they sort of started to turn things around then, they've beaten the Lakers, the Magic, and the Spurs. They split their games against the Rockets. They lost to the Pistons, and then they lost twice to the Cavaliers. But those losses to Houston, Detroit, and Cleveland were all close, competitive games. And so it's not like they're just beating up on bad teams.
Exactly. And they also, I think it was 2 weeks ago, I think, they also beat the Thunder nobody expected that game. And I didn't even, watching that game just made no sense because it's the Thunder. So I was like, okay, this most likely is going to be a loss for us. And they played some of the best basketball, I think. I mean, obviously a pretty rough game from the Thunder. But even that game, I was like, we're showing signs that we can beat good teams, especially come playoff time. I'm like, you never know. Honestly, you never know. And I personally can't wait for it.
Yeah, I think that was like what, early January or something like that. That was around the time where I think with OKC it was starting to become, well, maybe they're not gonna break the Golden State Warriors 73 win record. And then the Charlotte game happened, and that's where people are like, oh, it's definitely not gonna happen. And then the Hornets figure things out from there. And I think look, this season's amazing. I hope Charlotte. At first, I was hoping that they would be in the lottery to get a high draft pick again. But now it's like, okay, I hope they go all the way to the 6th seed and they compete and they have a chance to have a first round upset. That's where I feel now. But in all likelihood, the Hornets are not going to be hoisting the trophy at the end of the season.
It's going to end at some point. But the playoff run is looking good. It's
possible.
It definitely is looking good, but I was kind of hoping that too at the beginning of the season, because there's such a good lottery class coming up next year that I'm like, dude, if we could get a freaking AJ or something like that. But now I'm like, okay, honestly, they've been playing great. This is fine right now. I'll take this all day long.
Yeah. And I think regardless of when it ends and how it ends, they have 11 future first round draft picks. They have 15 future second round draft picks. They have multiple guys on expiring contracts, Bridges, Green, and Williams. They have some sweeteners for deals, Solon, McNeely, Kalkbrenner. Mm-hmm. The Hornets are in a spot with all the assets that they have and the foundation that they have that they could pursue an all-star or a star role player without losing one of their big three pieces, LaMelo, Brandon Miller, or Con Knipple. Is there a guy that you'd have in mind, Joe, that you'd like the Hornets to target this offseason?
I would like a big man. Honestly, I think Porzingis is an unrestricted free agent. I want a good big man because we have such a good, we have such great guards right now. Building around those big three, I think we're fine for a long time, especially being, like I said, I think we're the second youngest team in the league. So I would love like a good, just big man that can tie in all of our guard pieces would set us fine.
I think that's a good point because like Diabaty, as awesome as he is, you still want the ability to play with two bigs. And that's mm-hmm. one of the things that, you know, I mentioned earlier, OKC and Boston, both of those teams, they have a bunch of guys who can hit the ball, can shoot a lot of threes if they need to. And they had two bigs, the Thunder with Hartenstein and Chet Holmgren, sometimes Jalen Williams as well, and then Boston at the time with Al Horford, Kristaps Porzingis. So I think you could be on to something there with a big, not Porzingis though, because KP, he's got his POTS
health
condition.
Issues.
And
yeah
the health issues and all that. So I think a big would make sense. Do you, how would you feel if, let's say, middle of June, you see a post from Shams Charania and he says, the Charlotte Hornets are among the teams with interest in Giannis Antetokounmpo. Would you be excited? Would you be nervous? How would you feel if that were to happen in June?
I mean, obviously it's Giannis, so I don't think any team would ever pass up on a Giannis, but I'd be scared of who we're giving up for that Giannis. Brandon Miller, I think he is eventually superstar
off
potential.
Off the table.
I think,
off the table.
It depends on who we're giving up, but I would take a Giannis all day long, but it depends on who we're going to give up for that Giannis.
I think some of those expiring deals, Bridges, Green, Williams, and then a bunch of picks, like a very picks-heavy deal with maybe a Solon or a Kalkbrenner or McNeely, mm-hmm. something like that as a sweetener and a deal. And I don't know if the Hornets would have the best offer. I don't know if the Bucks would even want what the Hornets are able to offer in that type of deal. But like I said, 11 future first, 15 future second round draft picks. So they're sitting on a mountain of assets. They have flexibility. That's the point.
I mean, just imagine a pick and roll combo of LaMelo and Giannis. That might be one of the most unguardable. Like, I couldn't even imagine watching that. That's like a defensive nightmare. So I would love that. I mean, I would absolutely love that.
I think to your point, I'd rather a big that can shoot threes, though, because like then you could play him next to Musa Diabaty comfortably. I wish we mentioned Bam Adebayo earlier. I wish I could go for Bam Adebayo. I wish he would be available. Somebody in that spirit, a big that can shoot threes. That's like an Isaiah Stewart, like for Detroit, or maybe how about, here's a good one. Onyeka Okongwu from the Atlanta Hawks. I think that's a guy that I look at. I'm like, okay, he can do a little bit with the ball in his hands as a facilitator and DHOs and all that, comfortable, and he can play a little bit on the perimeter, but Diabaty can get that covered. Guys like that I'm thinking about for Charlotte. But I bring up Giannis because they're in a position where they have enough assets where they could make an offer. That's the place the Hornets are in right now, where they have this foundation that's bright, and that's bright today, and that's going to be even brighter in the years to come. And they can be in that conversation if they want to, or they can make some of these moves and kind of these lesser known names around the league. And that's what's exciting, man. Like Con Knipple's for real. LaMelo hopefully can stay healthy, and Brandon Miller. Looking like a star,
we haven't even talked
man.
About yet, dude. We haven't. I think he, and first thing I gotta say though, I do want to apologize. Whenever we drafted Brandon Miller, I wanted Scoot Henderson, so I would take my L all day. All right, I even tweeted like, we're not getting Scoot. I felt, and then now I'm like, I'm eating my words. I will publicly apologize for that. Brandon Miller is a future superstar. If he's healthy, he's listed at I think 6'7", but if you look. He looks taller than Miles Bridges and LaMelo. I'm like, he's 6'9". I think he's honestly 6'9" guard. I am a Brandon Miller super fan now. I don't care. He is unbelievable.
Yeah, he's putting it all together. I think that's just the way it feels like with him this season. Obviously, it was a little bit of a rockier start with him, but last, 2 months-ish or so, he's basically a 22, 23-point-per-game guy with elite efficiency from all three levels of the floor, playmaking, defending. The dude just checks every box, and that's why, I get plenty of things wrong on the draft. But I get plenty of things right, too. And one of the things I did get right was ranking Brandon Miller ahead of Scoot Henderson. And this was the point that, like with Scoot, he was a 6-foot flat guard. Brandon Miller at 6'7 or so, as a creator off the dribble, when you have that size advantage, it just provides more value in ways that you can offer make a positive impact to the game. And I think that's what we're seeing this year with Charlotte. And that's part of the reason for their success. He can play with these other guys and play in different roles. It's just, I just love this Charlotte team, Joe. And he can shoot too. I love him.
He's shooting 40% since his injury from three on 8 attempts at 6.
Crazy.
8, 6, 9. Like, he could spread the floor with con stuff. I am like a super fan now. I think he is like superstar potential. Like, here in a couple years, he's great.
You and I love basketball. You and I also love gaming. For people listening to this podcast who have no idea who Joe is, he is one of the biggest and best Call of Duty, Warzone, all game streamers. People can find you on Twitch and YouTube and all that. With Warzone, that's how you and I first kind of got connected, because I'm a Warzone fan. I like watching Warzone streamers, and you and Brad and Iron and Bobby Puff and all these different people. I've always enjoyed watching and rallied a bunch of guys. On Saturday, Joe, I played a bunch of solos for a few hours, and I had an all-time high 6 wins in a row in solos on Verdansk. And boy, it just felt good rattling off. 6 wins in a row.
You're moving. Also, where's my invite, though? All good. We can talk about that after the pod. Where's my invite? It's fine, though. But 6 wins in a row, you're back right now. I like that.
Yeah, it felt really good to have those 6 wins in a row using the heavy EGRT.
I love that gun.
The proof on screen.
Yes, he said, we're getting the screenshot in the proof. I'm getting it.
I almost hit 7 in a row. You see, I got second in the last game.
Second.
I had a one-on-one with a guy who was in a vehicle, a car. You know what's the spinny Sentry new equipment they have? I don't know what it's called. But he put two of those on his car.
Sniper.
Yeah.
That's so cheesy.
He had two of those on his car.
To get second is so cheesy. I'm like, oh man.
I know. It was on the hills north of prison. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. That's like the worst. That's like the worst area too of all end zones. It's like we're up here, of course. No. You know.
I love prison. Me and my buddies, when we play quads or trios, prison's our favorite. Just sit up top and snipe all game.
That's who's sniping at me. Anytime I go over there, I'm like, there's 4 guys up there sniping at me, so it's you. All right. Now I know. All right.
Yeah, that's off of me. Because that's typically the way that I commonly play when I play with my friends. When in solos, it's different. I like pushing, being a little bit more aggressive. A little bit of both, depending on what I feel like doing. But with sniping, I like playing more like Iron, pick the power position, hold it down. As Iron has always said, shoot at everything that moves. That's the way I typically like playing with my friends.
And that will get you wins over, it doesn't matter how cracked you are, how freaking good you are. If somebody has a better position than you, you will lose it 9 times out of 10. It doesn't matter how good you feel. It's like, man, I'm fried this game. If zone pulls towards a person that just has gotten there earlier and has played a better position than you, you will lose it 9 times out of 10 for sure.
Now, I thought the other day when I texted you a link to, I think it was a YouTube reel or something like that, of you talking about casuals. What's your thoughts on casuals mode and Warzone?
Oh, it's a hot take. I think it is one of the worst things that they have brought to Warzone. Now, obviously, everybody played, I think, in 2020, 2021 Warzone, where there was only 3 different modes, right? There was Resurgence, normal big map BR, and Plunder. And Plunder was that casual mode where people could just hop on and play and just have fun. Now, if you load up the game, there's 8 different game modes. And I just think that is just splitting the player base in so many just different directions. And it's hard for them to get a grasp on certain new LTMs, certain new modes, trying different stuff, because people are going to default to things that they like and have always played. And I think that the casual mode, which only fighting four or five other actual teams of players, and everybody else is 100 bots. Like, they're not even people. And I think that that has just changed the landscape of the game, where people aren't excited for a win anymore in a normal mode because it feels the exact same as casuals.
Yeah, I mean, I think with casuals mode, for however long it's been available, I didn't give it a chance until last month. And last month, I was like, I'm just going to try some casuals and see what it's like, see if they changed it at all. Because I remember the first time playing it, it's like the bots would just slowly fly in, and they're just, it's a waste. The bots shouldn't even be in the game, right? And they, it's still like that. The bots are a joke. If you die to a bot, you are a bot.
I feel like it's almost not impossible, but it's impossible. Very hard. Like it's very impossible hard. Because it's like they. But I just don't understand, because most people play it now to get guns leveled for camos and stuff like that.
Why I started doing it. I was like, I'm gonna level some guns up, get 40 kills a game or whatever.
Exactly. And I completely understand that argument all day long. But the mode that people did that in was plunder. That is how you got your guns leveled in camos, was plunder in OG Warzone. And even then, it's like, that's how it should be, not a casual mode that now you're playing to get guns leveled and stuff. And then people just stay in that mode because eventually there's a brand new map coming out, a blackout mode that's coming out. And I guarantee you, they're going to have a casual mode for that too. They had an LTM that was not casuals that everybody loved. They brought it back the next week as a casual LTM. I'm like, we're doing LTMs as casuals, limited time modes. I'm like, it's just splitting the player base so much. And I definitely understand for casual players, playing against sweats all day long is frustrating. But most of the time, I say people aren't going to be fighting streamers every single game unless you are a above average or good player. Skill-based matchmaking is still going to protect you and put you in lobbies that you belong in, not casual mode. I think that is just the worst thing that's happened to this game in a long time.
I agree. However, one thing I do have to say is, by playing it, I do feel like it made me better. Because I think that's one reason why it led to me feeling good enough to be able to win six in a row in a solo, because the way I was playing casuals, by trying to rank up by the key weapons I wanted to, I was pushing literally everything for 25 minutes straight, bounty after bounty after bounty, one-on-threes against crappy human teams, right? Like, they're not good. They're true casual players. And I'm 1v3, 1v4-ing them. And it's not like you playing on a resurgence or whatever with 1v4 against good teams where you're capable of doing that. I'm like got training wheels on, right? Against some not so good players, but I'm getting the experience of thinking in the moment of having to consider the spatial the placement of where those three or four people are and how to interact in those moments. And I think by playing fast, playing against multiple people, it did make me better. I feel like my game has leveled up the last 2-3 weeks since I stopped playing casuals after getting all those weapons done. It was an unexpected consequence. And so the casuals mode, I do think it's a shame that they have all those bots. I do agree it splits the player base, but I do think it has a little bit of usage to create some of those 1v3 or 1v4 experiences. And if they ever remove it, which I hope they do at some point, and bring plunder back, I'm going to use plunder for that too. I never realized
that's what it was always for. Yeah, and even in plunder, how people could fly in with their loadout and just fight as many people as you can. Now, if you don't, or there's some people that played plunder like it was supposed to be played and like farmed all the contracts to like win the game, that was the casual mode that you could do. Yes. But most people played plunder to just get guns leveled, get camos, just warm up in general, and that was that mode. And I think that even like swapping over then to small map, people played then small map and resurgence to fight people, practice your 1v3s, your 1v4s and things like that. And now it's just the casual mode. And again, I see the argument for it too of like, well, casuals aren't trying to just get 1v4'd like against streamers. But I'm like, okay. And you just said it too. It's like, okay, well, if you're also 1v4ing them in casuals, they're going to be getting 1v4'd either way. And most people aren't trying to just play the game and just get better, right? Most people play the game as a hobby for fun. And I think that skill-based matchmaking is still protecting them, even in the normal modes, to still have fun and not fight against bots every single game. I just think it's just gone too far where they're even dropping LTMs in a casual mode. It just doesn't make sense to me.
You know what I can't believe? How much Battlefield dropped the ball with their opportunity. I felt like they had an opening. Battlefield stinks, dude. It's just hard to believe.
Don't even get me started. I made that game for a month, and that's actually a great point on the casual modes, too. People are like, well, I think just gamers now are tired of BRs, and I would completely disagree, because in totally Battlefield, there was no casual mode, but getting a win in Battlefield was like, felt like peak Warzone, like peak Verdansk. Yeah. Now,
the fire and the flames felt awesome. It felt insane.
It's like, dude, this, like, getting a win was difficult. And that's why people played BRs, because getting a win is difficult. Now, in BRs, there's Verdansk Casual, which has the same cutscenes, the same fly-in, the same everything. And it feels the exact same to get a win in a casual mode as the normal mode, which is why people don't like playing normal modes anymore, because it's easier. And in my opinion, it's just a free handout to get wins, because you're only going to fight one other team at the end, or maybe two. So it's the exact same thing of just not trying to get a win. Now, Battlefield was insane because you knew it's difficult. Even the top players on the planet, they're not winning every game. So that was a lot of fun, and they just dropped the ball bad.
Yeah, big time, man. I mean, the lack of changes. The fact they don't have solos, or like, why can't you flip the switch and have chat? Solos?
Proc chat, I feel like it's the number one thing they have to add. And dude, even in other games, Arc Raiders, stuff like that, proc chat is like the number, especially solos here, it's just fun, but proc chat should be in that game. Solos, there's no map changes, no POI changes. They just dropped the ball. It was supposed to be like a $1 million tournament that everybody was stoked for. And now, like, we haven't heard anything about it. We're like, is this still happening or what's going on? So they just dropped the ball bad.
I know. It's really a shame. It's really a shame, because I was excited for it. I thought it would be a competitor to Warzone, but I haven't played it like in a month, and I don't have any anticipation of going back to it. Warzone has improved. I mean, I think, tell me this. I mean, I know you wear your in-ear monitors when you play. Uh-huh. Have you felt like the Warzone audio improved a bit? Did they change something? Because I feel like it's 100%. Suddenly improved, right?
100%. Now, right now, though, is like one of the worst audio bugs ever, which hopefully they fix like this week. But just overall, I think absolutely. They also changed it where, especially on the small map, it was very bad, where they buffed streaks. So like you would find way more mortars, precision, stuff like that. And they brought that back because it was bad for a while, where the only thing you would hear while you were playing is a mortar going off or a PA going off or napalm. And it was like, dude, I hear no footsteps because all I hear is just chaos, right? So they changed that. So that's way, way less of just kill streaks galore. But hopefully after they fix this like stupid audio bug that's been happening on console, PC, just everywhere, it should sound even better. So it's a reloading bug. Where it just sounds like you're reloading over and over and over. I tweeted about it. Dude, you got to watch it. I'll freaking send it to you later. Like, I'm standing still and all I hear is a glitch of myself reloading over and over. And you can't hear footsteps. And it's bad because like some people have it and some people don't. A lot of people have it. But for the people that don't, I'm like, count your blessings, because I hear it in my nightmare. It's so bad. Like, it's so bad. But fingers crossed, I have said it to the powers that be that it gets fixed this week. So we'll see.
I've not seen that happen yet. Thank God I haven't yet. Hopefully I don't.
Dude, you're going to laugh. You're going to be like, I'm so sorry. So hopefully I'm not gets fixed. We're good.
Well, Joe, thank you so much for joining me today, man. Always a pleasure to talk to you. Always a pleasure to talk basketball wars. And you said, thanks for the invite. It's an open invite to play with Joe. I'm not going to be the one to ask you to play. I'm not going to say, Joe, do you want to play duos with me? No.
Listen, there's a sweet camo too for 10 dubs in a row and then 25 dubs in a row. Wow. So we got to get you that camo because it's sick. But dude, I appreciate you so much for having me, man. It's a pleasure. And dude, I've been a fan for a long time, so it means the world. And I freaking appreciate you a ton.
Hey, Joe, I appreciate you. Appreciate you, man. I'll let you know when I come down to Charlotte, hopefully for some playoff games, and we'll grab some food down there.
Absolutely.
Thanks again to Joe for joining me. Up now, we got Ben Pfeiffer to talk NBA draft in this week's edition of Draft Class.
Hello.
All right, it's time for Draft Class. Joining me today from Swiss Theory, it's Ben Pfeiffer. Ben, how are you?
I'm doing well. Always excited to talk about this ridiculous draft class that has taken too much time in everyone's head, but I guess not too much time because it's just so many good players.
Not enough time. It's going to start taking more and more time. March is here. We're in now, Ben. We're a couple weeks away from the madness all starting up, and some of these names are going to get bigger. Some guys are going to flame out, but it feels like every single week, it seems like there's another guy we're like, oh, it's Kingston Flemings. Well, Mikael Brown has turned the season around. One of the guys that I've always liked and then I fell out of love with was Adai Mara. He is a Spanish center. He goes to UCLA. I was living in LA at the time, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to get this lottery pick on campus, like right near me. I lived in Westwood at the time, right in UCLA. And then he sucked for 2 years at UCLA. And then he goes to Michigan, and he's one of the best centers in the country. He's looking like a lottery pick. I know you have him 10th on your board. How has Adai played himself into the lottery this year? What's different for him now with Michigan versus his first 2 years at UCLA?
Yeah, I mean, crazy how much situation and context can change things. And also just like getting older, developing, getting better. But like you said, Mara was a like lottery plus level talent as a freshman or before his freshman season with his youth play in Spain. But two improvements to his physicality and scoring, he has developed into an incredible player. And yeah, like you said, I have him 10th on my board. Just his blend of passing and rim protection puts him in like really rare air. We've seen the kind of stuff like Donovan Clingan has done this year, and I think Mara is like a considerably better passing prospect than he was and probably will be. And he's improved a lot this year as a mover. He can play higher towards the three-point line and pick and roll coverage, which has helped him a lot. Like, you can't just pull him out and it's over anymore. Like, he still will lose to stretch bigs and quicker, shorter bigs and players who can shoot, but his shot blocking and playmaking and just really impressive skill with the ball to me give him a pretty enormous ceiling. And even though there's some weaknesses, like he fouls a ton, he can be kind of turnover prone, I think the upside with him is gigantic in a really interesting center class with a lot of fun players. But I think Mara, who, again, like you said, has just been one of the best players in the country, full stop, and has finally made good on like the high level talent that he's always shown.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the playmaking. That's one of the things it's hard not to love about him. He's not just like some stiff center. He's not just a run and jump guy. Like, did you see the pass he had against Illinois? I think he received the ball kind of on the,
yes, the wrap, cut, pass cut into around, the paint, yeah.
The wrap around to Johnson. Oh my God. I mean, he does that all the time.
He had a pass against TCU earlier, one of his first games in the year where he was just like totally stuck in the corner and like whipped a one-handed pass all the way across to some guy. And I'm like, this is not normal. Some of these plays, I'm like, I need you to chill and maybe take the check down. But like, I'd rather have a guy who's trying and has the vision and skill to make all these high-level passes and like rein it in as he gets older. But yeah, really incredibly talented playmaker. And like you said, just like the highlights are awesome.
7'2".
Yeah, 7'2", 7'3", very rare. Genuinely humongous person.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure like the assist rate numbers are historic. Yeah,
it's all time. I mean, I saw the Bart Torvik stat, how he has the highest assist percentage of any college player 7'2" or taller ever. I think the guy he surpassed last I checked was Roy Hibbert, his 2008 season for a guy 7'2", highest assist percentage ever. And like, so you have a guy who's a rim protector. You have a guy who can pass the ball. When he came into UCLA, one of the things I asked Cronin, I think it was like Cronin's first presser, like entering Mara's freshman season. And I asked, you know, do you have any expectations for him to shoot threes this year? He's like, we'll see. He gave like a typical Cronin answer, kind of a dick in a good way. I appreciated about his honesty there. He's like, we'll see. Well, we did see. He hasn't shot threes too much. And I think I'm not concerned about him not shooting threes, but the free throws sub 60% in his college career. Do you have any sense, Ben, that Mara can fix this, or is he just going to be one of those borderline hackable centers? Because that's the number one thing I'm concerned about with him.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty legit concern. Under 60% on 200 career free throw attempts is extremely poor. But I think for a player like Mara, with just like how big he is and how many fouls he can draw, like the bar you need to reach as a free throw shooter is so much lower than some other guys. Like if he can get to just like 65%, I think he'll be okay and probably be a guy who you can't hack. And his touch is pretty good, just like around the rim. Excuse me. He can hit some impressive touch shots with both hands. So I don't think it's hopeless in that term, but it seems like a lot of like tall guys like struggle with like the mechanics of shooting free throws. Like their bodies are too big to calibrate their mechanics the way they need to. So I think there's probably always going to be a ceiling on his free throw shooting, but I don't think it's going to be like, or I don't think it's destined to be horrible forever. It certainly could be. It's within his range of outcomes, but I do believe that he can improve quite a bit as a free throw shooter. And like, you know, get to 65, 70%, I think that'll be enough.
I think that's spot on, right? I think there's just reason to believe he'll become at least 65-ish percent. I just wish it would have happened by now to feel a little bit more confident about it. But if he was at that point right now, I think more and more people would have him in the top 10 like you do, or at least in the lottery like you do. Another guy I know you're high on, I want to talk about our weekly movers. Who's the guy that's continuing to inch up your board this year?
That's a good question. I'm a big fan of Cameron Carr, and I've continued to be high on him. I guess it's not fair to really be like I've been high on him all year, but especially just as he continues to play well deep into the season. Phenomenal three-point shooter, impressive shot blocker, and that's a valuable combination of skills that we just don't see a lot, like wings who can legitimately shoot threes off of movement, deep range like Carr has, but also legitimately block shots. And it's not just like he can guard the ball and get his hand on a shot. Like, no, he is jumping and blocking three-pointers. He's rotating like a big man and blocking shots at the rim. Like, super good player who's underrated to me.
Yeah, I like Carr a lot. I mean, he's like more than a 3-and-D guy, right? I think when you project him out to the 3 NBA.
And D, 3-and-D plus, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Do you have a comparison in mind for somebody who's listening to this? They're like, oh, I haven't watched Cameron Carr yet. Who does he remind you of?
What's a role he's fitting into? At least offensively, the combination of explosiveness and deep range shooting instantly reminded me of Trey Murphy, though I think defensively they're pretty different. Carr, I think, has a lot more potential on that end, but is 6'5", 6'6" instead of 6'8", 6'9". But yeah, Trey Murphy was the first guy that came to mind when I thought of incredible vertical explosive athletes. Like I remember some insane dunks that Trey Murphy had, like going back to Rice even before Virginia, and also like the crazy deep movement shooting, like sprinting off of screens beyond the NBA line. So that's a kind of approximation. And I think similarly, Carr is like not that impressive of playmaker, definite limitations as a ball handler. But like we've seen Trey Murphy make incremental improvements to those parts of his game throughout his career. So Carr, I think, is super undervalued. Just like had kind of a tough shake his first couple of years, had a bad injury his sophomore year at Tennessee, and just like never really played his first year, but was a great high school prospect. Played at Link Academy, where like Trey Johnson, Jacoby Walter, among others, played, and was to me like an NBA level prospect in high school, and is finally making good on that in his third year, or I guess like technically sophomore year at Baylor. But
you have him ranked 12th on your board. We mentioned Mara, you have him ranked 10th. One of the guys I'm interested in that you have ranked 8th is Jaden Quaintance. And people listening to this podcast, they might know Jaden Quaintance was a young prospect last year at Arizona State, 17 years old, had a really good year, just destroyed his knee, ended his freshman season, then he transferred to Kentucky. And this year, it's been up and down for him. He's played in only 4 games. He's currently sidelined indefinitely with soreness in that surgically repaired knee. Recently, CBS did a mock draft where they wrote that they'd be surprised if Quaintance doesn't go back to college after playing only 4 games this year. And then his his father made a post on X linking to that mock draft, and he said he will definitely be surprised. So his father is signaling that despite playing only four games this year, despite having a major injury that ended last year for him, that Quaintance is probably going to be going to the draft. I view him more, Ben, as a mid-late first guy. I mean, I know he's a transformational defensive prospect, but I just don't see a lot there offensively for me to feel like he's ever going to be a heavy minutes guy, a reliable offensive talent. But you have him eighth, and so you definitely must feel differently about him. Sell me on Jaden Quaintance. What's the case for him as a lottery guy still?
Yeah, I'll say just at the top, I am starting to get cold feet just because of, like, I don't like the idea that a guy whose game is predicated on explosiveness and movement skills is already dealing with such complications from lower body injuries. But my problems with him are, yeah, off-court injury related. I think I generally agree his offense is far away, but as a freshman at Arizona State, I think he showed enough ball handling and playmaking flashes to project him beyond a player like Bam Adebayo or Robert Williams. Like, you'll see him comp to defensively, but I think he's way more skilled and offensively capable than those guys at the same stage. And like what Quaintance did as a defensive player at Arizona State as a freshman makes me think that he could legitimately be a defensive player level guy at his ceiling. So even if his offense is always going to be limited, I think it's worth adding a guy like that in the lottery of pretty much any draft, even if he's not going to be an excellent offensive player. There's like an unbelievable athlete, psychotic explosion, like incredible leaper who can also move, switch out into the perimeter. But again, all is going to be like TBD based on how healthy he looks. And it's weird, right? Like the first game he came back against St. John's this year, he was phenomenal. He destroyed Zubi Ejiofor. He looked like a top five pick. And then in the next couple games against like Alabama, Missouri, and like some random team I don't remember, like he looked awful. So I kind of wish like if he didn't play at all, maybe it would be easier to like project him because we don't know what he looks like. But in terms of pure talent, I feel pretty good about having him as like a locked in top 10 guy. I think the defensive projection, like, he is one of these game changing defenders that can move the needle in a way that I think most individual defenders, especially like at a playoff level, can't because of his versatility, because of his shot blocking. I think he's going to be a great rebounder too. But I will say, I don't have like inside information, but just reading the tea leaves, I also would not be shocked if he didn't either. I mean, I guess maybe he's going to declare for the draft regardless, but it wouldn't shock me at all if teams were scared of him, right? Like, I understand it. He's very raw and has extremely concerning injuries at the moment. And, you know, obviously, I'm not a doctor.
It doesn't shoot. It just doesn't shoot. Yeah. Like he has 32 3-pointers and he's made only 6 of them. He's made only 45% of his free throws. 45%. Yeah. That's not sub 60. It's sub 50% with him. And he's a guy where I think the percentages matter a little bit more, especially considering he's a guy, you mentioned the handle, right? He can handle the ball in the perimeter. He's got some skill, some creation
skill,
especially in the open floor.
7'3" like Ademara.
Yes, exactly. And so that's where I look at it and I'm like, well, how much is the creation going to matter if he's a complete non-shooter and if he's a hackable player, 100% a hackable player? Like, and it's not just like, I don't think it's just like an easily solvable mechanics issue. His shot is ugly. It's an ugly looking jumper. Like, he needs an overhauled mechanics change. And so that's where I look at him. I'm like, I just got injury questions, the durability questions. As you said, if he's already got lower body injuries and he's so reliant on athleticism, can you rely on it to sustain moving forward? And then the shooting questions on top of that, offensive fit questions, if the shooting never works. I just got a lot of concerns where Quaintance to me is the type of guy where if I end up wrong, so be it. Like, if I'm drafting, I'd be okay with missing on Jaden Quaintance. That's the way I feel with
him. Yeah,
I'd like somebody else take him.
I think it's just going to be like every team's appetite for risk tolerance. Because if you're going to, if you hit on Jaden Quaintance, I think you're going to hit really big. And like, I probably wouldn't ever project him to shoot. I think I agree with you. I mean, it's it's a really rough projection. And even if it became just like kind of decent, that would be huge. But I think there's enough utility for his handle on like dribble handoffs and face ups and short roll passing that I could imagine him fitting in offensively. But if he's never like his full level of explosiveness, then I don't even know if it matters. But I will continue to be high on him unless we get like concrete information or something about his injuries. And in that case, I think, yeah, totally reasonable to be concerned. I just wish we could have gotten him playing this year at Kentucky. Like it's just unfortunate, obviously, and I'm sure it sucks for him to like be playing. Yeah.
Would have been so nice. But I mean, as you said, like it's going to be a matter of which team feels like they have some risk tolerance to take a guy like him. And I think there's, you know, there's some teams I can see taking a swing in the middle of the first round in the late lottery, but that's going to, I think he's going to declare as his father's suggesting. And then from there, we'll see what type of feedback he gets from NBA teams of whether it makes more sense to go back to school or to stay in the draft. Because if he gets intel like you're a early second round pick or a late first, he might be like, oh, dang, I got to go back to school for another year. And then next year in a weaker 2027 draft class, maybe then you can contend for top three, top four, top five pick. And there are going to be guys that end up doing that. It's just inevitable. Absolutely. It's going to happen. And that's
there's going to be guys who do that who we have no idea, who we're not even thinking about right now.
There'll be surprises that we don't expect. Like Keaton Wogler, it could happen. I'm not going to rule it out.
That thought crossed my mind. I don't think it's going to happen, but it did cross my mind because you never know.
I think he's going to take advantage of the hype right now. And
it really is. You never know. NIL just changes things. Like it changes how prospects can think. And I think that also needs to change how like we as draft people think about age and about prospect development and about go back to school, go to the draft decisions. Like there's so many different factors that are beyond now, like just the pure level of the player. Like it used to be like, oh, if you're good enough, you go. If you're not, you're probably not. But now it's like, oh no, Yaxel Lindeberg could have been a first round pick last year. Mm-hmm. But like comes back, is the best, you know, best player in the country or right there, and is going to be a lottery pick now. So obviously these things cannot work out too. Like maybe Jaden Quaintance comes back, he can't shake his injury stuff and it never works out fine. But I think there's people are realizing and players and agents are realizing that there's a lot more benefits to like playing in college and getting those high level like in-game reps rather than like one either going lower than you want or even if you go where you want sitting on the bench and not developing, because unless you land in like the right spot, you're not going to develop the way you should.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think for some of these guys, it's going to be a tough choice and might also depend on intel with what they get. And some guys just want to go to the league. They don't want to do college. And so we'll see what happens there. I think, you know, we'll see how much the middle of that first round, the late lottery range gets diluted. Like some teams could end up getting hurt there. And I think you look at the Western Conference right now with some of these teams, we know who's going to be in the play-in. Like the teams currently in the play-in in the West, the Suns, the Warriors, Clippers, Blazers, none of them are going to drop out. Like nobody's catching the Grizzlies. It's only a matter of who's going to move up. And the Clippers don't have their own pick. The Suns don't have their own pick. The Blazers do. The Warriors do. So those teams do have a little bit of incentive. If Denny Avdia is out for the year with that back issue with Portland, maybe you don't want to slip into the playoffs. The Warriors, Stephen Curry, they announced he's out another 10 days as he's still nursing his injury. At the time when Steph's injury was first announced, I tweeted, "Let the tank begin," as a quote to Shams mentioning the right knee injury that he's dealing with. This was back on February 19th. And a bunch of Warriors fans, understandably so, are like, how? Like, you can't tank. There's no chance you can get out of the play-in. I don't mean get out of the play-in. I mean stay in the play-in and stay in the play-in at the spot where you can be a team that loses once and you're out, and then you might have the 10th or 11th best odds. That's what I mean when I say maybe it would be better for the Warriors just not to bring Stephen Curry back and get a chance to move into the top four. Like you talk about adding to Stephen Curry and Jimmy Butler and Draymond Green and how old they are, and talk about having organizational flexibility. if I'm the Warriors, I want that chance to move into the top four personally, instead of getting shellacked in the first round by OKC or San Antonio or Denver, whoever the opponent would end up being in the first round out of the play-in. I want a lottery pick if I'm the Warriors, but there's no guarantee, obviously, with the 10th or 11th odds or 12th odds you would move into the top four. You might just be picking there. Is there a player that, for Warriors fans to think about, that you would love as a fit next to Steph Curry in this core, as a more successful second timeline guy than James Wiseman or Jonathan Kuminga? Who do you have in mind?
Yeah, let's I think this would be a good chance to atone for the two timelines thing and just like pick good players or get high level talent for whatever era comes after Steph, Jimmy Butler, Kristaps Porzingis, Draymond Green. But I really like the idea of them adding more juice to their backcourt. And LeBaron Filon is a name that I have as like a lottery plus level grade that continues to be available in that range in mocks and big boards. And I like it because Filon is this year one of the highest usage effective creators in the league. I mean, last time I checked, he was 30 usage, 60 true shooting, has been basically all year. Phenomenal player on the ball, incredible stop start, great handle, improved shooter. But like for most of his career, his freshman year at Alabama, was a very successful like off-ball complementary player. So I don't think he'd have any trouble fitting into that kind of role next to Steph Curry, next to whoever. He's a great cutter. He's improved as a catch and shooter, but also has this ceiling to me as one of the most impressive creators in the league. So that would be a very cool one for the Warriors to add. For me, I like the idea of the Warriors kind of not necessarily like abandoning the win now timeline. I just have a hard time seeing this extremely old core staying healthy enough and like realistically making a playoff run together. Obviously, I think you always have to accommodate Steph Curry to some level as long as you're actually, you know, in the business of trying to win basketball games with the Golden State Warriors. I also like the idea of them taking a center, a big guy. Again, all of their centers are super old, or like Quentin Post. I like Patrick Gongba a ton. I think he makes sense as kind of, yeah, playmaking big. The Warriors love, I mean, I think people have comped them to Al Horford, and I can definitely see some of those shades. Like exceptional passer for a big, can really dribble, pretty fluid mover, and like a smart rim protector despite not being like an exceptional athlete or anything. So I think those two, Filon and Gongba, I think would both be incredible and kind of fit two different needs and things that the Warriors could benefit from. But I think the Warriors could go like a ton of different ways, honestly. And I think yes, it would always be nice to like move up more, but I do think there's a good chance that like this middle of the first round could still end up being, you know, super loaded relative to most drafts.
Oh, for sure. I mean, like, who knows if a Michael Brown, if he ends up being one of the four or five best players in the draft class. You can't rule that out with some of these guys that could be there in that 8 to 12-ish range for this year's class. It could be a special group, and depending on who stays declared. And I think, you know, one of the things that's going to be interesting down the final stretch of the year is, so Kawhi Leonard came back this weekend for the Clippers. Darius Garland is making his debut on Monday against the aforementioned Warriors. So the Clippers are back to full strength. They got their new point guard back. They got Kawhi back. The Clippers are still in the play-in right now. So they're only, you know, five games back from the Suns. It's going to be hard to catch them the last 6 weeks or so, but they're only 2.5 back from the Warriors. We're about to find out these next few weeks with Darius Garland and Kawhi Leonard. Are the Clippers going to move up and be in the play-in and be in a good position to get into the playoffs, or are they going to be in this spot with injuries and still in the 9 or 10 spot where they could be eliminated, giving the Thunder another lottery pick? We're about to find out what's going to happen to this storyline that really dominated the beginning of the year, with the Clippers being at the bottom of the NBA and the Thunder being on pace for 78 wins. Well, the story could return to close the year just with the Clippers being in the late lottery instead of the bottom of the barrel of the NBA. But I've said this on my pod before. People hate me for it, Ben. I would love to see OKC move into the top three or four. I just think the drama would be hilarious. It would be one of the funniest possible outcomes. I do. In this regard,
It would be an objectively it would be an objectively funny outcome for some people. I think for a lot of people, it would be absolute nightmare disaster fuel. I wouldn't really care that much. But I think the idea of them getting a late lottery pick in this draft is still terrifying, even if not like as abjectly terrifying. Hey, I mean, what about OKC as like acquaintance team? Like if he declares that they like him, you let him sit for a year or two.
Exactly.
No reason to rush it. Yes. No reason to rush him back. Like they've already done that with Topic and Sorber the last couple of years. They clearly are not like going to be. Honestly, like kind of an inefficiency they can use because like they can't play these guys anyways, really. Like OKC isn't going to have the room to play whatever. Like unless they get like a Darren or Cambusa or like whatever. If they get a top three pick, they're going to find room to play that guy. But if they get a lottery, you know, a late lottery pick and it's someone like, I don't know, like a Quaintance or like an Ament if they like him, even though I don't think they'd probably like Ament. But yeah, I think that is a terrifying proposition because like I said, I think this area of the draft is pretty strong and I think there's a bunch of different ways they could go. Like Yaxel Lendeberg would be instant
Yaxel and OKC. God. any of the names you throw out, any of them are scscary. They're scary.
By far the oldest. Sam Presti. I've done a lot of research on like the Presti draft history over the years. I believe he's only drafted 2 23-plus-year-olds in his entire history as a GM, and those were Sasha Kahn in 2008, I believe, and Keontae Johnson a couple years ago, and those are both second round picks. So he's like. It would be a complete outlier based on his history to take Yaxel, but also like it would be so good. And the Thunder are in a very different place. So part of me is like, I don't think they're going to do it because I think they trust their principles and they believe in their philosophy. Like, understandably so. It's gotten them this far. I get it. But man, just like that missing piece, like big wing forward defender. He's a huge add on the offensive and defensive glass, which is probably OKC's like biggest macro weakness still in certain matchups. Yeah, I mean, that would be unfair. That would be completely unfair.
I mean, even like a Koa Pete, like all his struggles as a shooter, you put him in OKC and hopefully help him improve. No rush, like somebody like that, and see if he turns into something. That's the thing. Like you're hitting the point. They can get a really good player at 10, 11, 12, or 15, wherever that pick ends up. If it moves in the top three or four, obviously that's incredibly scary. People would be raging and very sad and disappointed and all that. But my point is that OKC is going to get a good player, whether it's in the top four or whether it's in the middle of the first round. And I just would love to see the drama to see how it plays out. Same with San Antonio. With the Hawks pick, I'd love to see them both move up. It would just be a hilarious outcome if that happened come lottery time in May. We have 2.5 months until then, 3.5 months, almost three full months until the draft. Ben, please let people know where they can follow all your work.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Just at BJPF on Twitter, my name, Ben Pfeiffer on YouTube, pretty much where I'm going to be pumping out content, written video up until the draft. But yeah, I am as enamored with this group as pretty much everyone else. I do think even after like the deadlines for returning to school, it's probably still going to end up being a really strong class, even if it's not going to, obviously we don't know. And there's going to be, like we said, some people returning that we just have no idea.
Yes, absolutely. Ben, thank you so much for joining me, man. Keep up the good work. Big thank you to Joe O and Ben for joining me on today's episode. We'll be back again on Thursday. Got Tom Haverstraw and hopefully a special player guest as well coming on Thursday's podcast. Thank you to Emmy and the whole team for producing today's episode. Thanks to Father John Misty for the music. Hope you enjoyed giving us a listen. Talk to you later. Have a good week.